I'd like to welcome all of you to the colloquy, Sexuality, A Search for Perspective. Today's is the 18th lecture in this series and concerns this week's topic, marriage and the family. Next week's topic is value considerations for moral and ethical decision making. The three lecturers for next week will be Drs. Otis Maxfield, Lester Kirkendall, and Roy Menninger. I'd like to invite all of you here present here today to continue your participation by attending next week's lectures. Barry Amos will introduce this afternoon's speaker.
Today, as you probably are aware, we're going to hear from Miss Virginia Satir, and it's my pleasure to relate a few facts about her to you. I had the opportunity to speak with her, and Miss Satir has traveled widely and has done a great deal of lecturing and speaking on this subject of marriage. And in connection with our sex colloquy here, I asked her if it didn't get somewhat tiring just traveling around and speaking all the time. And she said something which made a great impression upon me, which was that she was trying to make things live. And if she were to go somewhere where there were people, and if they and she wanted to learn together, that it all made it worthwhile. And I felt that this was very significant, since it's not just a purely academic exercise on her part. In order to familiarize myself more with some of the work that Ms. Satir has done, looking over her vita, she has had teaching assignments in Wisconsin and Michigan and Florida and Missouri. She's been a supervisor of counseling for the Association for Family Living in Chicago, director of residential programs, Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, and she's traveled widely and lectured widely. All of this being quite impressive and quite a long list of activities, I thought perhaps to familiarize myself even more, that I would go out and read her book, which is Conjoint Family Therapy. But being a romance languages major, I'm more accustomed to making love than trying to explain it or understand it. So I'm going to leave the explanations to Ms. Satir.
Thank you very much, Barry. Well, I hope that in the time we have, excuse me, about 50 minutes or so, I have to do a real rush act to get a plane by 5:55. So when you see me right at 5 o'clock go whoosh, you will know what it's all about. I think that's an important thing to let people know what you're about. At least, as I have said to many people, I would much rather you would that I would be hung for my own reality than your fantasy of me. So that's kind of how I want to start out here, too. I thought that as I presented to you some of my ideas about the family as a teacher of sex, that I would emphasize both the ways in which I think the whole sexual delineation comes about as I've come to know families, and then perhaps some other material that might be relevant as we go along. As you know, all of us were born with capacities for development. We were born anatomically different, but the fate of that difference lies not only with our anatomy, as you well know. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. I also would like to remind you or to inform you, if you have not already, if you do not already know it, that a good deal of what I have to tell you came as I looked at families over a period of many years. First, to see how I could help them to relieve their pains. And as I went about the business of helping families to relieve their pains, I learned a lot of things, which I'd like to tell you about today, if I can. You know, if you think about the development of a family, we're really always starting out of context, if you think about it. Because you see, if there are any of you who are married here at this point in time, you are probably well aware that you are the sons and daughters grown up of fathers and mothers that you had. So where do I say that the family starts? Well, I suppose you could go back to Adam and Eve, but that wouldn't help too much for what I have to say today. What I'm trying to point out is that at any point in time, we are never able, really, to start off fresh as far as the development of a family is concerned. The only place where we've got a reasonable chance of starting off fresh is when we are born, but we start off in an unfresh context, because the people that are around when we are born have already had an experience which has shaped some of their ideas about how life is, how it should be, how it can be, what their way is of how to make it so. So what I'm trying to say at this point then is that all of us began in a situation which had already to some degree been programmed for us, in one sense. Now, if you think back, and some of these things may seem a little simple-minded, but I found that it's easy to go to the complicated, and sometimes we are in the upstairs without knowing that there's a basement underneath. So some of the things I want to remind you of, just to keep it within the perspective so we can look at it. Everyone in this room was born little. And when you were born, you had all your ingredients for growing. I think you know that. Now, the question of how you were going to grow was partly in terms of your constitution, partly in terms of what you were fed and how you were sheltered, and very much in terms of the directions that you got from the people around you. See, there's a characteristic also about the newborn. You can't do anything for yourself except cry. Well, you can do a few physiological functions, but you can't do very much else. You are also like a sponge, in a sense, of soaking up whatever there is around you. You have no preconceived idea of what it is to be a male or what it is to be a female. The only people that have that kind of idea when you're born are your parents. And so, if we begin to look then at the fact that whatever any of us came out to be, up, let's say, to the age you came to the university, or 19 or 20, and some remain after that, whatever your ideas are about what maleness and femaleness is all about, and whatever your ideas are and your experiences about what it is like to be male and female, is probably much more related to the program you had than to any of your inherent characteristics. One of the things, if any of you are anthropology students, or even without being anthropology students, know that there are many styles throughout the world and have been through the ages of how the male-female image evolves. There's one thing, as I looked in every culture that I could find, every single culture has an image of how the sexes are different. And there is by no means agreement on what the image of a male is like in the Arapesh society, Margaret Mead writes about, and a society here in the United States. That is, what a male is not the picture of what he is, what he does, and so on, is not a comparable. And there's not any universal picture of this. Now, to me, this is a very important thing. That is, that given the anatomical difference, And that is true. We can't gainsay that. Given the anatomical difference, which provides a difference by itself, the image of what else this maleness or femaleness is will depend upon the program. Now, if it were a simple thing, that is, if we were brought up one with simple programs, and I want to talk about that in a minute, and if two, all of the things we learned about how to be who we are were within the awareness of our parents, there are many things we would not have learned. What I'm saying here is that because of the nature of ourselves at birth and as we grow, that we take in everything, and we have to do something with everything we take in, so that we many times get things from our parents that they never intended. And furthermore, that the other thing I mentioned, which was that males have programs for how males and females are to be, and females have programs for how males and females are to be. Now, here we come into one of the crucial points, which is that how then does the male and female who had experienced long before we came into the world, that is our males and females, how do they both discover and put together their images of how we are to be? With just a little reflection, I am sure that every man in this room, and when he thinks of himself as a male, thinks of himself not only as the male that he is, but he thinks of himself in reference to other males and in reference to females. Every woman in this room, when she thinks about her sexuality, thinks about herself as a female, also thinks about herself in reference to other women and men. So what I'm trying to build here is that it isn't just a simple kind of recipe. If I'm the adult female in the family who is married and giving birth to a child, it's not just a simple thing of what do I think is a male or a female, but what do I think is a male and a female, and how does that relate to other males and to other females? Now, if you can kind of keep that in your mind while I'm talking, we might be able then to see that a lot of what I think comes into the sexual hang-ups, it's true, it has something to do with the genitals, perhaps a lot, but it has, it seems to me, more to do with how the adults who were the people who directed us got together on their differences, on all of the things that they believed that were true toward developing a male and female. Now, I also want to say something else, which is that I think every parent wants to develop the very best male and very best female that their services, their interests, their images can provide. So when I come into families and I find that there are people who feel weak about themselves as sexually delineated people, I see this not as any outcome from somebody's design, but rather as an outcome of confusion, of ignorance, and of lack of awareness. Now, I think what would be useful, I want to work here, and I'm going to turn this light on, can you see that all right above my head and all that, even the people that are down here? All right. See, what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to say, in view of what we are doing right now, sex, sexuality, maleness, femaleness, difference, and sameness, together, pardon me, together with communication, are all important aspects when we think about the simple thing about sex. So if I have somebody that comes into me who has a problem in impotence, men, they usually have the impotent problems, sexually shown, or a female who's got frigid, let's say, whatever that may mean, or a man, a father who is sleeping with his adolescent daughter, we call it incest, or mother with her son, which is also incest, or some kind of exhibitionism or voyeurism or some other kind of name that obviously involves the sexual organs per se, either in terms of their use or misuse, one of the places I go is not to the sexual organs. That will get there sometime, but that's not where I start. Where I start is, first of all, with the communication. And as soon as I get to the communication, I need to look at what are the rules in the family for handling differentness. What are these rules? What happens in this family when, let's say, the adult female comes up with a view A and the adult male comes up with view B? Then what happens in terms of what C gets from that? C, in this instance, being a child. What happens? And when I get to this part, in terms of differentness, you already foresee, I think, the next part of this, which is, one, that it is impossible, humanistically, to always be at the same point, at the same place, with another person. No matter how much you love them, no matter how much you value them, to give out a message that you are at the same place with another person, always at the same time, is to make you a liar. Either that, or you're dead, or you are out of awareness, because this just cannot happen. Probably 0.1% of the time this could happen, but it can by no means be relied upon. Therefore, it is in the nature of the human condition that one will, if he manifests himself in terms of himself, will be constantly meeting the idea of differentness between himself and another person. So the crucial point becomes, how does this get utilized? What kind of experience does the C individual have, especially if A and B, in this case the adult male and female, mother and father, how they handle their particular differentness? Now, on the face of it, anatomically speaking, males and females are already different. No, I hear no parents who argue to me about the anatomical difference of their child. Never found that, because it's very easy to look for and to find out, and most people accept it. In fact, I've never had anybody that didn't accept it. So that difference is almost accepted as a universal. But then how to manifest this becomes the big problem. All right, now you got a woman. A woman. What does a woman know about what it feels like to be a man? She's got to get it all on hearsay. So whatever, if a woman has a male child, what kind of messages can she give him from her own experience about what it feels like to be a male? Nothing. You know what she can give him? What she can give him is her picture of what it feels like to be in the presence of a male. But she can't give him anything about what it feels like to be a male, not directly. Now, who can give him this information? The adult male can give the young male more direct kind of experience of what it feels like to be a male. Now, let's take the female. No male knows what it feels like to be a female. He doesn't know what it feels like to menstruate, to wear brassieres, have breasts, and so on, just like no female knows what it is to wear a penis or to have heavy shoulders. So the female can let the young female know what it is like to be a female. She certainly can give her more information than the male can. The male can give the female all of the experience of what it feels like to be in the presence of a female and how a female can be seen by a male. Okay, now let's suppose that if you accept this, which I do, you may not, but I do, that the adult male takes it upon himself to argue what a female feels like with his wife. What kind of experience will this be for the child? Suppose the woman takes it upon herself to argue with a man what it feels like to be a male. Well, there's a certain kind of trouble that comes out of this. So this question of what is maleness and what is femaleness and who can talk authentically about it becomes a very important question. Now, I've already indicated that it isn't enough to just learn, if you're a male, from another male what it's like to be a male. You also must learn, if you're a male, what it is like from a female to experience a male. So that we not only then have the direct information from the female to the young female about what it's like to be female, but we also need, this young female also needs from the male his feeling of what it feels like to in the presence of a female. So she begins to get some kind of a picture that her sexuality has two very important parts to it. The part of her female part and her part of herself which relates to the male part. And one of the things that I found in families was that people were under the impression that to become either male or female, all you needed was somebody of the same sex. And as a result, of course, we find many families in which it looks like one or the other parent has been kicked out of his job, so to speak, and only one parent is left. Almost without, at least with the people I've come to know, without exception, the people who children who grow up in this kind of a situation where one parent either decides that he's the one to give all the messages about maleness and femaleness, or the boys go for the boys and the girls for the girls, and both parents don't take the leadership that they can give and what they can give to each child. These people grow up to have troubles with themselves as a sexual person and with the other sex partner. So this calls for some kind of a pooling between the adult male and female, as far as the child is concerned. But before they can do anything in the pooling, they need to be aware themselves about what they can feel authentically about or what they can talk authentically about and what they cannot. And to be able not only to be aware of this, but to be able to translate it in such a way so that it comes clearly to the person who is to be sexualized, if you will, which all of us need to do, and we will be, willy-nilly. Question is how. Now, one of the things that I've noticed is that every parent seems to have a high degree of investment in how his children will be. I've heard so many men who will comment on their boy children, "I'm afraid he's a sissy." Or so many women comment on their girl children, "Afraid she's a tomboy," with a kind of feeling that this is somehow not good, which I agree will have some holes in it. But forget that one of the most important ways that they will be able to give information is by their own modeling in their communication with each other. That is, that the male can show that he is ignorant about what the female is about and can listen to her tell him. But for the female to be able to tell him, she has to be willing to tell him. The same thing is true for the male, that the woman has to be able to find out from him so that he can tell her, and pooling this. Now that requires some belief. And suppose that the male tells the female something about what it feels like to be a male, which is different from what she heard her father say about what it was like to be a male. I have a case in mind where this woman had a father who never showed any anger. He said it was unmale to lose your temper. Well, of course, what happened was there's a difference between losing your temper and showing anger. Now, her husband was able to show anger. She considered him unmale. She didn't believe him. Now, her image was that a male was somebody who shouldn't show anger, never mind what her husband did. So she set about, every time she got a chance, to treat her young male, to try to teach him never to show any anger, because this was unmale. Well, you can already begin to see that this young male would get messages from his father by the way the father modeled himself, because father lost his temper and he began losing it more and more. That he got the message from his father that maleness meant you let your feelings of anger out. From the mother, he got the message, don't let your feelings of anger out. So the child at that point then was at a very crucial point in his sexuality. What was he going to do? If he followed his father, he could let himself be in touch with his anger. If he followed his mother, he better keep it in. So, in this particular case, what he did was he followed his mother. Because father did something, which was, father could tell this boy in private, oh, come on, stick up for yourself. But when he was in the presence of his wife, he shut his mouth. And so what happened, I saw this family, this boy happened to have been, I saw him when he was about 15, already a fairly well-developed homosexual male. And when I went back in this, I found these kinds of messages that were involved in his growing up. Or right, let's take another kind of a situation. Everybody knows that they're covered with skin. This is quite clear. And there's something else that everybody knows too. That not only are they covered with skin, and that that encapsulates them and separates them from other people, except in Siamese twins, and we go through surgical procedures so that people can do that. But there is also something else. We all recognize that all of us have an independent toilet operation. That is our elimination. I hear of no people who say, you must go to the toilet the same time as I do in order for you and I to believe one another. Somehow that escaped it. It's well that it did. But anyway, we've been in worse soup than what we have. All right. So what I'm getting at here is that the question of whether one spouse believes the other spouse about what it's like to be the sex that he is, and can he, in addition, show appreciation for the sexuality of the other spouse? Now, I could almost substitute another word, which would be the word differentness. Can the spouse appreciate the differentness in the other spouse? Sexuality, you can put all the other kinds of things that you want to in relation to what comes under the subject, the heading of differentness. One of the things that I find is there's a terrific amount of disbelief between males and females about what it's like to be a male and a female, because people have preconceived ideas. Furthermore, I find that the idea that if I'm going to be a sexually delineated person, I have to have in myself a picture of the sex that I am and a compatible picture of the other sex so that I can move freewheelingly in relation to both of the sexes. And for that to happen, it is required, as I've come to understand it, a kind of interaction between a husband and wife where differences are used for growth, for getting closer connected, and that there is a high degree of belief and trust which leads to a high degree of appreciation. So when the little male child is aping his father, maybe even if in his father's faults, the mother can look at him and say openly to him her appreciation of him as a male, her criticism of him of what he's doing, just as easily as she can say this to her husband, so that she doesn't get into the bag of having to criticize in her male child that which he is emulating from his male forebear, and criticize the boy while not criticizing the husband for the same thing. In other words, being straight is what I'm talking about here. It's a very interesting thing that I have found, that people who cannot openly be straight and trust cannot appreciate. They cannot appreciate each other. And so this has a, when I think about the whole sexual growth, this business about the appreciation of the sexes. Now, the minute that you get into the appreciation factor, you have transcended the business about who's right, who's better, who's on top. You should excuse the pun. So what we are desperately needing at this point, which I think is a crucial point in the sexuality development, is a way of going between men and women based upon a way of getting in touch with all differences, not just sexual differences, but all differences, in which it is then possible to make growth use out of the differences instead of separating. Now, there's another factor to this. There are many, of course, but I'm picking out a few. All of us, I think, as we've gone through life, have developed some areas in our life which we feel ashamed of, fearful of, embarrassed about, and so on. And it so happens that in life, a lot of these things have to do with the physiological outcomes of our sexual differentiation. By that I mean menstruation, childbirth, intercourse, all of these things. And that we bring into the family a lot of hidden, taboo-like reactions to many of the things that have to do intimately with the sexual business per se. And so this also gets into the picture, all of the taboos about this. Now, you might be interested in, when I work with a family, where I find that people are, in some way, their sexual selves are being not developed, or they're having some kind of problems with them. But the first thing that I try to do is to get them to talk straight with each other, in an effort to try to get them to look beyond whatever it is their taboos are. Now, you can't very well look beyond this until you begin to develop some trust in each other. And you know, there are interesting ways. I don't know if you're sitting beside anybody right now that you have any particular feeling about. You may know you're sitting beside of a body. You may know or not know this person. You may know this person and you may not know them well. You may have feelings of trusting them or not trusting them. I don't know where you are in relation to who's beside of you. But the chances are very great that if there's somebody beside of you, you're reacting to them in some kind of a way. All right. Now, in terms of the fact that you have, at this moment in time, toward the person in front of you, beside of you, touching you, or what, some thoughts in your head, some feelings in your gut, and you may even have a whole series of fears, I don't know. Now, I would like you to just imagine telling the person beside of you what's in your head, your body, and your feelings right now. Just to imagine. Just the way it is, man. Just to imagine yourself doing that. Right now. All right, now you might then, with this, you might begin to have in your awareness, gee, I felt that, but I better not say that. Or, golly, I finally got a chance to say something because she told me it was okay. Or some beginning to feel drawn back a little bit. Or as you begin to be aware of some of the feelings that you have, you may also at the same time begin to be aware of certain body things going. Your back may be tight. Your muscles in some way may be reacting. These are all possibilities. Now imagine not only that you were saying what you were feeling, what was running through your mind, but you were also to give a report to the other person about what your body was doing. Gee, my gut's turning. Or, you know, at this moment, my back is tight. Now, when you think about having this idea in your mind about being able to share with the person beside of you what your inner space activity is all about, you can get some kind of idea of what could stand between two people and not talking straight. If you have never had the experience of giving to somebody else as full a report as you have at a moment in time about how you are feeling, what your body is doing, what you are thinking, and to notice that this is a means of drawing you closer rather than separating you, then one of the things that could stand in your way is that you would not tell people what you thought on the basis that you would divide yourselves. And this is one of the things that happens in the family. That is, that the myth that is held is that if I say to you what I feel and think, you will obviously take yourself away from me. So one of the things that I need to do is to be able to provide some kind of way in which one, people will take a risk. Take a risk because they have no previous experience by which they can measure this. See, when you take a risk, you take a risk. That means that you've got no previous kind of design to go by. And so you're going into the unknown. Some of you may have had the experience of what it feels like to go into the unknown. You go into the unknown, not with the idea that it will turn out right or wrong, but with the idea that you will discover something. It may be painful, or it may be joyous, or it may be anything. But that's what the payoff is in terms of taking a risk. You are going into the unknown. It's a funny thing. In some of the lectures that I've heard and some of the comments that I've heard from students, have in some of the groups that I've been, the business about going into the unknown with another person. Some people have gone into the unknown with the conversation with another person, but they may not have gone into the unknown with trying to find out what that other person feels or thinks about them, or take the risk of going into the unknown by telling that person what they think or feel about them. Now, in the family situation, unless this can happen, there is really no way that is not fraught with difficulties that the developing child can get what he needs to make things straight for himself so that the father that says to him, show your anger, and the mother who says, don't do it, that both the mother and the father are going to be able to talk about what they feel like and to be able to meet these differences by also bringing out their feeling, not being afraid to come to some kind of an altercation, because they really can know that they can take the risk of what will happen to keep things straight. Probably if I use two words that I think will bring things back to center in any human relationship, is the business about talk straight. Talk straight, which means talk fully from where you are, not where you should be or what ought to be, but where you are right now. I've had amazing results with people in families where, for instance, girls were being very promiscuous at age 12 and 13, in which there was impotence or frigidity, in which there was voyeurism or exhibitionism or any of these kinds of things. And when I work with people who are not in this kind of thing, the kind of aliveness that comes with people being able to be in connection with what they're really feeling. Because you see, there's something else. The whole sexual thing, as far as I can tell, is very much related to our aliveness. You know what a nice juicy feeling it is if you are a female to feel good about feeling female, and when you're in the presence of a male to feel even better about feeling a female instead of feeling worried? What a nice feeling it is, and this I can't talk from only from hearsay, but what men tell me, how they feel even more male many times in the presence of a female. Now, if I can make this point, you see, if you have to say which is right, then you see, when you come in the presence of a female, if you're a male, then you have to decide, am I better than her or she better than me? The competitiveness comes into it. There can't be any kind of real communication that makes people close together in a situation in which one is constantly deciding who is better, if you follow what I'm saying here. Now, the aliveness factor, the juiciness feeling. See, I have a feeling in this conference that one of the big payoffs that is coming here and has already probably come is that the aliveness factor has increased in the whole faculty and in the whole student body. Not only because people could talk openly about things, but people could disagree. Nobody dropped dead. All kinds of taboo subjects could be raised. And what happened as a result, as I've been around the campus, and I've been around quite a bit, like almost like on a merry-go-round, was a feeling of aliveness that I was feeling from people. Have you noticed that? As you students and faculty, I can't see you very well. But the feeling of aliveness that has come. I wonder if some of you have found that you are able to talk more about subjects that you hadn't been able to talk about before. Or to talk about some of your feelings on your insides as you're talking about these subjects that you never talked about before. Well, see, this has a direct relationship to your sexuality. Has a direct relationship to your feeling of aliveness. It has a direct relationship to your feeling of worthwhileness, your own feeling of worth about yourself. And it also portends a great deal of joy and pleasure in a kind of connection with another human being, and if you're female, with a male, and if you're male, with a female. Now, what I'd like to do at this moment, I think it's about 10 minutes to 5, and I'd like to turn this off momentarily so I can see you. I've kind of felt in the dark a little bit. And see if, at this point in time, anyone has any kind of a question that they would like to put to me. See, what I've really been trying to do is, in a maybe oversimplified way, to talk about what I think is really the basis of the sexual development, after which the genital use is imposed on this kind of thing. So I'm wondering if anyone at this point in time has any comments or questions that they would like to make right now. Sir. Question comes, should you discipline a child at the same time? Let me say this. I think that when both parents are present, each parent, if he puts out what he sees as what fits at that moment in time for the child, and that the child can see, if it happens to agree, then this is one way. If the parents disagree, then the child has the chance not only to get his experience in discipline what it is, but also to get his experience in how people manage differentnesses. When do you know what I mean? All right, let me try it again. One of the things that I see happening is that there are two parents present. The kid does something that, needs some guidance. All right, at that point, maybe father will say, stop what you're doing, or go to bed, or reach for the ruler, or what. Now, at that moment in time, this is not the way mother sees it or feels about it. Now, instead of what happens in most families, is that the a mother may shut her mouth with boiling inside or feeling weepy inside and let this kind of thing go on, giving the child the kind of impression that she really agrees with father. Another way, of course, is that the woman starts to clobber him. That doesn't help much either. But the point that I would suggest is that when this happens, the child is in the presence of both parents, the child is able to hear from each one how that parent perceives it, and then to see what happens between the two of them, to watch the two of them work out their differentness, and then he gets the benefit of two things. He gets the benefit of guidance, and he gets the benefit of two parents interacting on the basis of differentness. See, this I think we need so much of. There, I hear lots of families who say, well, we never fight in front of our children. I said, my God, too bad. How are your kids ever going to learn how to fight? And they say, well, we never differ. I say, true or not true? Well, they'll have to admit to me that what they do is they try to make it look like they never differ. Because I have to say, you're either liars or you're never together. And one of the things, the very thing that is the basis of our openness, a basis of our aliveness, is differentness. It's my differentness from you and yours from me. Do you know what happens to you when you encounter sameness all the time? Bored stiff. You know what would happen if everybody you met was just like you? They said the same things and did the same things? You'd want to go jump in the river. You know, people commit suicide much more for boredom than for anything else. So that this, all of the opportunities that can happen in a family for managing differentness, how this is done, not that it is there alone. I heard one mother say to her son, you know, your father and I disagree about you, and stopped. All right, now that came through the mother's mouth to the child, happened to be a 15-year-old, and so he was left to his own devices about what this really was all about. You notice I said it in kind of a biting tone, so that there were dire implications, but that's where it stopped. So the willingness, the interest to capitalize on differentness is to me an essential thing. We have a funny old wives' tale. Maybe I shouldn't even blame the old wives for this, but the idea that if I love you, I agree with you. Most terrible thing there is. As I said, first of all, it's a lie. And secondly, it is something that if you try to make it work, some of you girls here may have tried to work out something with your husbands where you disagreed with him right down the line, but you thought, oh, I ought to agree with him because his ego will be hurt. And then you got into the shovel technique. You know what that is? You know, when you run around trying not to hurt your man's ego, in the meantime, you are boiling about something, or you are feeling little and insignificant. Well, you must carry your shovel with you, because once you start bailing out the male ego in your own mind, you got to keep doing it to keep yourself from feeling so bad. So there's this aspect of the thing. And that whole business, you see, there you can see another implication of that, that the idea of sameness, maleness and femaleness as being the same, also leads to the thing that isn't so. Males and females are different. And so that how to make that differentiation. I ran across a family once where they had 5 kids. All the kids were of different sex. Well, you know, only 2 different sexes scattered. And they always dressed them all alike till they were 6 years old. Same hairstyle, same clothes, all alike. I nearly vomited when I saw that. I saw nothing to differentiate. And what did they tell me? They said, well, you know, they're just children. They're just children. And forgetting, of course, that children start becoming human beings at the age of 2 hours of age. Do you realize that? Do you know that you will never hear better than you did at 2 hours of age, or see better, Only thing, you can't just tell people what you're hearing and seeing, because you don't have anything to relate it to. And we now know that, so that this whole matter of sexual delineation starts right at birth. There really shouldn't be any babies, and I'm giving you a bias. There are boys and girls. And so that boys have something that is different from girls. I don't think we'd have all this penis envy and castration problem if we started right off with the idea that we have males and females in the world, not babies. We have baby girls and baby boys, but they're males and females, right from the beginning. Have time for one more question, and then I see I have to go. Let's see. Let me not be discriminating. Didn't I have a woman before, or did I have a man? I forgot now. All right, I'll take two. I can't stand it. All right. The gentleman. I can't hear you. Well, all I'm saying is, you see, on research data, medical research data. Well, you can find, I can't give you any references at the moment, but any pediatrician will tell you this, any surgeon will tell you this, any gynecologist will tell you this. That all the senses are available. Oh, I'll give you one, David Cheek. I'm having a little difficulty hearing. It's funny, when I'm talking back to you, I don't really need to hold my ears, but anyway. You see, this is a discovery. We used to think that the senses weren't available 4 weeks, 6 weeks, but it isn't so. If you want a reference, look for David Cheek. Now there was a lady. Now wait, I heard the first answer to your, the answer to your first question, is there some particular difficulty? Yes, the answer is yes. Now what was the second part? Yes. Well, I can only give you something encapsulated, because this is what people come to me for a long time to find out about. But a peculiar kind of communication goes on in a family which produces a person who does not have the other piece of his sexuality. And it goes something like this. The male, there's a male child, let's take the male homosexual. And he is, first of all, in that family, the woman is the spokesman. So she is the one that calls the shots. And the papa goes along. Now, mama can't call the shots unless papa lets her, but the kid doesn't know that. All right, now that's not going to make you homosexual yet, so don't worry, because some of you may have had that kind of thing. All right, now then there also has to be a message that males are more important than females. That has to be in the context. So what we have now is a picture that the words say males are more important than females, but in actuality, mama's calling the shots. Do you already see the discrepancy coming? All right, so then there's a third one. And that is that the child is asked by the female not to be like his father, and at the same time scolds the child for not respecting the father. You get that together and you got something going. I gotta go, goodbye.
Ms. Sater, on behalf of the audience and the university, I'd like to thank you very much for being here and contributing to our aliveness. Unless there are any announcements, we're dismissed.